Okay, so what you just saw then was this thorium source sending alphas that will ionize this gas. If you look, you can just actually still see it. It would still work for an hour. If you came in late, you might want to come down and look at this needle and the wisps that come off. So hopefully this helps convince you that, in fact, there is such a thing as radiation. And so we started talking about last time, and if you start to think about the atom, and you realize that Rutherford's experiment with the nucleus is very small, so the positive charge and mass is in at the center, relative to the size of the atom, the nucleus is really quite tiny. But what this means is you have to have a new force that holds these positive charges so tightly together. And we've learned from Schrodinger's equation, quantum mechanics, that if you have a binding potential, you'll actually get discrete energy levels. So you can imagine that we have a deep attractive potential, which has a size that's about 10 to the minus 15 meters, which you know, because if you send charged particles at the nucleus with increasingly, if they're positively charged particles, with increasingly violent energy, you'll get closer and closer to the nucleus, which is Coulomb resultant, up until you reach about 10 to the minus 15 meters, and then new things begin to happen. So we know that it's Coulomb to that range. And so, just like what we have with the hydrogen atom, we get the discrete energy levels. The neutrons and the protons are fermions, which means we basically can fill the energy levels up.
Yeah. Does the strong force fall off very quickly at a distance, or does it simply not act after something?
The strong force is very bizarre, and if we have... Well, I'll try to schedule something and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit on Friday. I'll give you some feeling of the strong force in and of itself. But it's a strange sort of force that when you have particles really close to one another, it actually is fairly weak. And then it gets enormously strong as you pull them apart. So strong that you get other particles coming out of it. So when I call this the strong force, it's a... might be considered slightly a misnomer. Let's just table that until either Friday, or I may try to schedule an optional lecture where I'll talk a little bit about particle physics and cosmology, just because I like that as a way to bring a lot of what we've done in culture. Certainly won't be on the test, and you know, you can't make it. There's a place there where I can really address that better. So if you're in a nucleus with lots of neutrons and protons, they're separate types of fermions. They're fermions, so they can't share the same energy level as, say, two neutrons and protons. So you have to fill those energy levels up the way we do the atomic energy levels in a multi-electron atom, separately for the neutrons and the protons. And these energy levels aren't quite the same because the neutron doesn't feel the Coulomb force. So when we look at the potential for it, it's a little bit different. But one important thing is that the separation in these energy levels, because the binding is so strong, it's now millions of electron volts, and that means that nuclear physics is inherently different energy scale than atomic physics. And different things can happen because you have these different energy levels that are separated by so much energy. So we have to have basically symbols to specify what we're talking about. So generally we'll have an atomic symbol, generically X here, but it will have some particular symbol, H for hydrogen, HE for helium, etc. The number of total nucleons, and Z, which basically is a one-to-one mapping to the symbol, which represents the number of protons. And then we have a number of different types of radiation that you'll typically see naturally in nature. One is gamma radiation. And gamma radiation is very similar to what we have seen with atoms, where you have an electron dropping from one higher energy level to a lower energy level and emitting a photon. So you have exactly the same process here, where you have an excited state nucleus, and you can emit a photon by dropping into a more stable state of the same nucleus. And these will typically have many thousands of electron volts or millions of electron volts in energy. We call them gamma rays. You can also have different sorts of processes. So you can have a process where effectively inside the nucleus a neutron converts to a proton, or a proton converts to a neutron. And then to conserve energy and momentum, you kick out electrons and a particle called neutrino. And there's a nice story that basically when people were studying beta decay, these transmutations of one nucleotide type into another. So for example, beta decay where an electron comes out, you have one of the neutrons converts to a proton and you emit the electron. And so this type of nucleus actually converts into a completely different type of nucleus. But when people looked at this, and I can't remember whether I asked you to solve this in a workshop or not. Yeah.
Is there some sort of property with this?
If you can't hear anything, feel free to move that so loud. Say why?
Is there a special property associated with an electron that is emitted to beta decay as opposed to one that's just orbiting?
No. Electrons and electrons and electrons.
Why do you need to call it radiation? Why not just call it?
I think it causes problems. So why do we call it subradiation? In the early days, all you knew was protons coming out. And it wasn't characterized as a sort of radiation. It was irradiating whatever it is. And now, radiation is a scary word. But radiation is static, right? Electromagnetic radiation, you don't want to get it out. And a lot of this, as I hope to get to later on, has a lot of fabulous uses. So, I mean, whether you should be scared of something or not depends on a lot of different factors. So, it's sort of bad. If you think of just the neutron converting to a proton, there is a mass difference. If you have the neutron go to a proton plus an electron, the two-body decay, when you calculate the energy of the electron exactly, what you find is you'll get a spike, because of just momentum conservation. And it turns out when you go and measure it, what you find is the distribution in the electron energy is where that value you would have calculated with the two-body decay is the highest value you can measure. And this was a huge puzzle for a while, and Wolfgang Pauli hypothesized that there was a third particle involved that wasn't readily interacting with matter, and that spread the energy out and explained the beta decay spectrum. So there's quite a story there where this particle and its large, some of its properties were predicted about 20 years before it was ever seen experimentally. Another type of radiation is, you can sort of think of it as the emission of a helium nucleus, two protons, two neutrons. And a way to think about that is the helium nucleus is a pretty stable configuration, and you can think of it as having some coherence even within a nucleus itself. And then it has a non-zero tunneling probability of actually just on the other side of the boundary, and that's a way of actually modeling alpha decay. But what happens in alpha decay is you lose four nucleons and Z drops by two. And so these are really very different beasts, and we're going to talk a lot about that as I get to the end of nuclear physics. So you get diagrams that are rather different from what you're used to with atomic physics. Here, not only only can you have a high energy shell where you emit a photon into a lower energy shell when something drops, you can have transmutations of one element into some other element with these sorts of transitions where you're actually changing Z and A. In this case, just Z. The A stays the same because you don't change the number of nucleons in beta decay. And you can have different nuclei that can do many different things. So if you go to the table of isotopes and you look up in detail what some particular naturally radioactive nucleus can do, what you'll find is you'll have, it's many things, and you have to think about what it is. So in this case, most of them emit 0.31 NeV beta decay. And then often what you'll have is when they do that, they'll be in an excited state, so you'll then get a cascade of gamma rays.
What is the factor?
That is, A would be a symbol for years. I don't know this particular isotope. I wonder if A might be some other unit of time. But that's basically how I would just, the half-life is 5.0.
What happens to the electrons? Because on the previous slide, you had a bunch of like nuclei flying around. I wonder what happens to the electrons that were used in there.
The electrons in the atomic shell?
Yeah.
They're still there, but Z just changed out from under them. So their chemistry probably has to get pretty strange.
So there's a ton of ion particles.
I don't know about a ton, but they'll reconfigure if the new atom, I guess. I don't actually know what transition is like. Might be an interesting, but probably pretty hard thing to study. Okay, so if things are naturally radioactive, then you've got a couple of things to worry about. You have a sample here, it might just disappear in time. The other thing that's in the process of disappearing is spewing crap out that you might not be so happy absorbing. So we need to be able to get quantitative about this. And if we imagine that we have one particular type of isotope that's naturally radioactive, what I'd like to do is to study how the number of nuclei change with time, because basically that will give you a measure of how many decays per second are happening in this substance. If it's naturally radioactive and each of the nuclei has a certain probability of decay, and you don't know when it's going to decay, but you know it has a certain probability, it means that if you're sitting out here looking at this sample, the number of decays per second you should see is going to be proportional to how many nuclei are there, because each one will have a certain probability of seeing something decay. So this minus sign says that they're decaying, so n is getting smaller. And this lambda is the proportionality constant, and that is specific to the type of nucleus. Some nuclei are very unstable and will decay very fast. Others are more stable and they're going to sit there. I don't mean nuclei of the same type, but nuclei of different types will have different characteristic decay times. And that is what this lambda represents. We call it, because we're so great and descriptive, we call it the decay constant. So n is just the number of nuclei you have sitting in the sample. The rate which n is changing is also a measure of how many nuclei are decaying per second. So that's sort of a measure of how hot the sample is, how many decays per second might, in fact, be getting. This quantity is typically measured in curies, or perhaps in millicuries. But one curie is defined as 3.7 times 10 to the 10th decays per second. So to look at the behavior of this, if we have it set up this way, let's analyze this equation. So I want to pull the n down and the t over to get this equation. And now I want to integrate both sides. And now I want to ask, if I go from 0 to time t, how many nuclei do I have left if I started with n0 nuclei? So I integrate n from n0 to n, and I integrate the time from 0 to t. So this you should probably recognize as a natural log. So you get the natural log of n over n0, and the right-hand side is just the integral of minus lambda. So you get minus lambda t over there. Take the exponential of each side, and you end up with this, which is a characteristic nuclear decay equation. So what it tells you is that the number of nuclei in the sample drops exponentially. Okay, from time t, where you start with n0. So just like what you've seen with time constants in electric circuits, same equation basically. Lambda gives you the characteristic time curve, right, of how this thing goes. In a time of one decay constant, the number of nuclei is going to drop by a third, right? That's the one under each electric circuit. Now, so probably if it were just physicists and we were looking at it, we were inventing it today, we would probably not invent this particular quantity, but it's the one that's been invented and we have to use it. Instead of talking about the time it takes for things to fall by 1 over e, which is sort of a natural thing to talk about in mathematics, we're sort of stuck with the fact that people talk about how much time it takes for the sample to drop in terms of number of nuclei by a factor of 2. We call that a half-life. So that ends up, we get a little factor of 2's log 2 that's stuck in. So the relationship between half-life and the nuclear decay constant is this. Half-life is 0.693 over lambda. And this actually turns out to be something that's just useful enough. I go ahead and memorize it. Clearly, you put it on your paper. I'll put it on the formula sheet. But you'll find that, if you're doing anything that remotely involves nuclear stuff, you'll actually be using this a lot. Because about half the papers you look at will be publishing something with half-life, and about half the papers you look at will be using the decay constant. So you're constantly having to go back from one to the other. But notice there's an inverse relationship. So a short half-life is something that decays very quickly, but that corresponds to a big time constant. Okay? So you can do lots of fun things with this. And there are many, many, many applications. And once you basically understand how the activity can change with time, there are all sorts of really fabulous things that people cook up. And I think I asked you to do a few homework problems, which you're not handing in, but I guess I should tell you about that. I posted a new problem set. You do not need to hand anything in, but you do want to look at it because we are covering chapters 41 and 42 in advanced nuclear physics is on the exam. When I finish nuclear physics, we'll stop covering anything that's on the exam. And if I have time, I'll talk about some cool stuff, but none of that will come. So you will have this week's workshop and the problem set that I posted will be lots of practice problems on nuclear physics stuff. I'll get the solutions to that last problem set up ASAP. I did not try to do it yesterday. So I'm not waiting to post that. I'm going to just go up there. Again, I want you to think a little bit about the problems before you do them, but I understand that we're ending the semester, so I'm not expecting to spend months in that time preparing for you to handle it. Okay? You all right with that? I think you understand. Okay. So one of the really fabulous things you can do with this kind of stuff is radiocarbon dating. And the way this works is that Earth is constantly being bombarded by what we call cosmic rays, which are highly energetic charged particles, many of which come from the sun, and some come from astrophysical sources. And it turns out that our atmosphere provides really fabulous radioactivity shielding for us. So most of these particles will, in fact, interact with nuclei near the top of the atmosphere. When they do, they will cause nuclear reactions. That's one of the ways in which they interact with things. And there is carbon in the atmosphere up there. There are other things, but one of the products that comes out of the interaction of cosmic rays in the atmosphere is the creation of a type of carbon, an isotope of carbon, which is carbon-14. Carbon typically has 12 nucleons, and that's rock stable. But you can have an isotope of carbon, which is carbon-14, which naturally decays by beta decay with a half-life of 5,730 years. So there are a couple of absolutely spectacular things that intertwine and to create a really great tool for us. One is that this carbon-14 diffuses and is disseminated throughout the atmosphere. So you're breathing it right now. And as you breathe it, chemically, isotopes are not different. They differ by the number of nuclei, right? The number of neutrons. The number of protons stays the same, so the atomic shell structure and whether one neutral or not, the same number of electrons, all chemistry really depends only on the number of the protons. Okay, large, there may be very tiny ones, but it's really large. So that means this carbon-14 that's in the atmosphere, you breathe in, you incorporate it, you eat, it is part of you. So there's some small fraction of carbon-14, and I don't have the fraction up here. It's not a huge fraction. And so then what happens is when you die, or when anything living dies, you stop ingesting the carbon in the atmosphere. And the carbon-14 that is in you today is decaying, so you are glowing beta rays. As you die, you will continue to decay, or as any organic thing goes. Okay? And so long as you don't have something that really contaminates that site, what you have is the dead thing, the carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio will drop time as the carbon-14 decays away. So you can actually look at this ratio and get an estimate of when it died. So, you know, a silly example is, you take a sample of stuff from some archaeological site and you measure the carbon-14 activity, how many decays per second you see in the carbon-14, which you can tell from other things because it'll have characteristic beta energy. So you can tell what it is. If that activity is 25% of what you see in normal living stuff, how old is that sample? When did that thing die? After one half-life, so after about 5,700 years, the activity will drop by a factor of 2. It'll have half as many carbon-14. After 2 half-lives, it'll drop by another factor of 2, which is down to 25%. So it's somewhere around 11,400 years old, something like that. So you can do this very precisely using this formula, right, that relates the activities or the number of nuclei. But of course, the solar system and cosmic rays and the magnetic field of Earth, which affects sometimes the cosmic ray flux and all sorts of things, and how things get mixed around the atmosphere, everything is variable. So if you actually wanted to go out and do serious carbon dating or something, you have to calibrate it for the fact that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere varies a little bit from year to year, depending on solar activity and other stuff. And so you have to calibrate it. And one of the ways, many ways you can calibrate it in the sense that people find things, but the simplest thing is you can go and look at an old tree, and you can cut the old tree, and every year, the tree has a living region that dies, and you get a tree ring, and it goes out year by year. And it turns out that when that ring dies, the carbon 14 that's in that ring is from that year. So you can literally take a tree ring slice and work your way back from the year the tree died, year by year, and look at the amount of carbon 14 and figure out how much carbon 14 is in the atmosphere that year. And from that, and other techniques, you can see here the green line is a tree ring. You can see it's buried by a lot of data. But basically, lots of different sources, you can calibrate for how much carbon 14 is in the atmosphere. And so this is calendar age years up to about 40,000 years ago. So the half-life is dropping. You know, you're halving the carbon 14 by a factor of 2 every 5,000 years. So this only works for things that are only so old, right? If it gets much older, there's just no carbon 14 there, and so you're not going to be able to measure anything. But it's a really great technique for measuring the age of historical sites, largely, I mean human historical sites, because you have carbon things and you have this well calibrated for that period. There are other techniques that you can use to date things that are more geological, and I think I have a problem or two where you can look at ratios of other things that have long half-lives that you can figure out the age of rocks and stuff like that. Yeah.
How do you know that the carbon 14 is, so how do you know that it's 25% of a full or not?
Well, you know the mass of the sample.
Oh, okay. And how do you also know that it's not, it wasn't regular carbon 14?
Well, one of the things you would have to do if you were trying to radiocarbon date something is to have some sense of the sort of the sanctity of the site
on average
in that time. So you wouldn't want to pick a sample from a site that might have been contaminated recently by a lot of crud or something. You know, you don't want other materials to be contaminated. So it takes some thought. Okay, so just like we have, we're used to talking about atomic binding energy. And remember, so we have these different energy levels, and remember that they actually have negative energies, which means it takes energy to remove an electron. You have to do work to remove an electron from the atom. And we call that the atomic binding energy, if you will, or the ionization energy. So if you want to calculate the ionization energy, you could literally take the energy of the separate parts. So this would be the energy of an electron that's not moving, the energy of a proton, say a hydrogen atom, and you can subtract from that the energy of the bound state, the ground state hydrogen atom. When you do this calculation, you'll get 13.6 eV, which is the ionization energy for ground state hydrogen. Okay? So I hope that looks okay to you. You can do the same type of thing with nuclei. We can take a nucleus, say some nucleus X, and look at its mass. We have the total amount of energy in that nucleus. It's going to be the mass of that nucleus times C squared. That's its rest mass. We can take that and subtract it from the amount of energy you would have for its constituent parts that are not bound together. So I can take the number of neutrons I have times the mass of neutrons times C squared, add it to Z times the mass of the proton C squared. So this would be the total energy available for that many neutrons and protons all separated away. And then I subtract from that total energy the amount of energy I get if I were to stick them in that nucleus. And you'll get some energy left. So this literally is the amount of energy you gain by taking these constituent pieces and allowing them to bind together. Right? And we call that the nuclear binding energy, because if you want to think of it that way, that is the amount of energy it would take if I took this stable nucleus and ripped it apart into its constituent pieces. I have to put that much energy in it. That's known as the nuclear binding energy. Typically, we talk about the nuclear binding energy per nucleon to get a measure for how tightly nucleons are held inside a particular nucleus. If I have a bigger nucleus, I'll have a bigger binding energy overall because I have more nucleons. But if I really want to know how hard is it to take a single nucleon out of that nucleus, which is really more what we're talking about with ionization energy, then I'd like to look at the average binding energy per nucleon in that nucleus. So that's what this BE over A is. You okay with that? Alright, so what I want to look at now is how this binding energy per nucleon, that is how hard is it to remove a nucleon from that nucleus, how that changes with the total size of the nucleus, that is the total number of nucleons. Okay? And this, if you are sleeping, wake up, because this is the single most critical curve in nuclear physics. And I don't have it there. To go here. Okay. So what I plot is the binding energy per nucleon here versus A. Alright. Note the units are millions of electron volts. And note that I'm going from low up to high, but an average value might be somewhere around 8 million electron volts per nucleon to take the nucleon out of the nucleus. Okay? What I hope you notice is you have a very bizarre structure here. So as you add nucleons, this grows. That is, the nucleons are held more and more tightly until you reach a certain size that's around iron 56, iron 57. And then this begins to drop as you get larger. So, to sort of motivate that, let's look at what's happening if you are thinking of a nucleus, okay? Each nucleon basically is sensitive to the strong nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force has sort of a limited range. So, and it's very strong. So as I add some new nucleons in, the new nucleons will also interact with the other nucleons that were there. So everything gets held a little bit more tightly together. So as I add more and more nucleons, the binding energy per nucleon is going to grow. It's held more and more tightly because they're all sort of working on each other with a strong force. I reach a certain size, the nucleus itself starts to be larger than that nuclear force range. It still combines itself together because A is glued to B, which is glued to C, which is glued to D, so the whole thing doesn't fall apart. But A is no longer really sucking on E on the other side of the nucleus, because the nucleus is now getting too big. But as I add protons, because the nucleus is getting bigger, I have Coulomb force is still at work. So you still have this repulsive thing. So what happens as I add more and more nucleons, I end up basically becoming less and less stable because it's now too big for everything to bind itself, and I have more and more Z, which is sort of working to try to push it apart. Yes?
So we would expect that, the radius of the nucleus of an iron atom would be about the maximum distance over which the strong force is acting.
Within the context, so the question is, would we expect the radius of the iron atom to be about the distance of the strong nuclear force? And in the context of what I was just sort of painting for you conceptually, yeah, that would sort of make sense. in reality, because you have Z also in there, right? So you have this strong nuclear force, but at the same time, you still have Z working against you at this point. So at any rate, that's not a bad thought. Okay? Yes?
How come there's limited range? So it makes it sound like there's a central point for that, the range starts. Right? How come the outside, how come we're talking about the outside? Why wouldn't that be able to start its own range?
Well, it does. It's just this one over here and this one over here no longer really talk to each other. Okay. Whereas over here, these two can talk to each other because they're close enough. But as I make it bigger and bigger, you're no longer able to. I mean, think about a crowd of people talking to one another. If you're right beside each other, you're able to talk to some limited sized crowd. When the crowd gets big enough, even if everybody's sort of quiet, it becomes harder and harder for you to communicate with somebody far away in the crowd. That's sort of the way to think about it. The nature of the confining aspect of the strong force I'll come to, but I'm not going to do it.
All right, so
why is this so important?
This is very characteristic, this, and the fact is not characteristic. This is very important, and note that the peak is about iron, but look at what happens. If I take two nuclei that are relatively small over here, and I somehow added them together, I would take two from this region and I would end up with something under here. The total binding energy per nucleon has increased, which means the nucleons would be held more tightly than they were when it was too small. And that energy then is released. And that's what we call nuclear fusion. Fusing these two together. If you have something huge over here and you split it into smaller things, you end up with smaller things over here. Again, you're increasing the binding energy per nucleon from what you have with the big thing into the two smaller things. And you release energy from that big thing. And that's called nuclear fission. Okay? Now, if you want to think about this, here, in principle, you have a big nucleus, and it's got a lot of stuff trying to sort of put it apart, and if you hit it and you can cause it to go apart, it does relatively easily. Okay? Here you have a problem, because to take these two nuclei and put them close to one another, you must overcome Coulomb reaction. For fission, in a sense, the Coulomb reaction is working for you to divide this nucleus. It sort of wants to do that. All you have to do is push it and go. But with fusion, it doesn't matter how stable that new thing is going to be, I still have to overcome the repulsion of this Z and that Z to get these things close enough to one another that they can ever mind. And this is essentially what makes nuclear fusion so hard to do. Yes?
Would you expect the trend for the overall number of certain atoms in the universe kind of mirror this thought?
So the question is, would we expect the trend for the overall number of atoms in the universe to kind of mirror this? Really where the universe is concerned, you only have to be concerned up to about right. Here. I mean, in terms of the universe, it's almost all hydrogen, and you have a little bit of lithium, a little bit of boron mixed in, and that's about it. Everything else is just almost not there. I forget the percentages of this. So, where does all this other stuff come from? I mean, okay, so we'll talk about it in a minute.
But yes, and there's a lot of history, there's a lot of reasoning behind that. So maybe that's the cosmology lecture I'll tell you about those ratios at the early universe. But we're going to talk a bit today, I think, about how some of the other stuff comes about. Remember, this Coulomb force is very important. So if you were to map the number of protons versus the number of neutrons for all known nuclei, what you find is that the stable ones tend to have more neutrons than they do protons, because you add a neutron, you're increasing the nuclear force, but you're not increasing heat. So the Coulomb repulsion isn't so great. There are, we don't have stable nuclei, but they're just neutrons, so you do need to put protons in there. This is called the line of stability, where these black things are, and what you see here are all the known types of nuclei, and they're colored by different types of nuclear decays, and many of them can do gamma, but you don't change nucleon. You don't change nuclear type, and you can do a gamma irradiation. You're just changing the degree of stability that you have. So the number of neutrons is typically larger than the number of protons up to a point, and you see this line of stability. Okay, so there are lots of things that you can do with the binding energy to nucleon concept under your belt. So I'd like to start that discussion by looking at nuclear fission. And here's a very particular process that is very important. And it's where you take a nucleus, U-235, and if you hit it with a relatively slow-moving neutron, we call it thermal neutron, it will actually be sufficient to cause the uranium to split. And when the uranium splits, it'll split into rubidium and cesium. And let's see, we go from 235 to 93 and 141. So we're going from something here to something here and something here. So each of these have a much higher binding energy per nucleon than that original uranium. So there will be energy released, and that energy comes out in a number of ways. It comes out in cascades of gamma rays, and it comes out in kinetic energy of these nuclei, and a release of two neutrons with kinetic energy. Okay? And now, this turns out to be a very important process for us because you start, you initiate one neutron and you release two. So you have the possibility of creating a chain reaction of these things happening at once. So if you have a situation where you send in a neutron and you cause a split, and you generate these two neutrons, and those two neutrons, one of them will interact, so you'll get a split, but the other one will largely escape. On average, if on average, for every neutron that is generated in a split, one of them causes another split and the other escapes, you call this a critical situation. So you get about one split per split. If you have where on average most of the neutrons escape, it's called subcritical. And here you may be irradiated a little bit by neutrons, and if you have a lot of stuff here, you need to worry, but it's not too bad. If you have a situation where you have enough matter, enough of the U-235 around, such that these neutrons are going to interact with other nuclei before they escape, then they will also cause a split of that nucleus into two neutrons, who again will not escape, and you'll have an exponential increase in the number of neutrons and the energy produced. And this is what we call a supercritical state. If you reach this, then, you're generating a lot of energy very fast. And so that's what you really have to watch out for.
So 37 to 58 is more than 93. What's that? How are we getting it?
These are this is the number of nucleons.
Yeah.
So this is Z.
Yeah.
Is that that?
So you're creating protons.
Yes. Ah, how about that? Okay, I must have something wrong. Yeah. So we have three.
Consider the overall total mass being 93 plus 141 plus the extra two neutrons is.
I think there is a little bit missing here, actually. We may have a couple of things to get that off here, too. I have to go and read from that. The essence of it is contained here. But yeah, there may be. You do want to conserve charge. So, and we're not. Okay, so critical, subcritical, and supercritical. And then you can do lots of things with this, with some care. So if you have two subcritical pieces, and you're able to get them together and hold them together momentarily so that it doesn't destroy itself so fast, then you actually can create an explosion. So that's a nuclear bomb, a fission bomb. You can also put these subcritical masses sort of close to each other, so they get close to the edge of criticality, so you have lots of splits happening, and you can even put a material in here which can mediate effectively the number of neutrons you have. So you can have rods, subcritical pieces that are embedded in stuff that can absorb neutrons. And you can pull those rods out of this stuff if you want to have more neutrons bouncing around and increase the amount of energy production. Or you can put it back down and have the neutrons absorb mostly and control it. So the idea then is to have them grow hot enough that you can actually heat up some sort of circulating liquid and do a heat exchange. You don't really want... You'd like to do a heat exchange over here because what you'd like is for this substance to not be too radioactive. And then have, you know, basically the water or whatever drop is seen from it. So that's the basic idea behind a nuclear power plant. You need to be taking this heat out because these things will get hot no matter what. So the big problem in Japan right now is they have lots of cooling rods in the pool, and so long as they keep the water flowing and everything, they're fine. But they just take what heat away they have. It's subcritical, so everything's okay. But if the cooling water stops flowing through, it gets hot, and it will boil away. And when it boils away, things get very hot, and then the fuel elements will actually melt, and you can cause fires, you can have things that are subcritical now collect and be critical. So you can get a real... It's not contained, so you're not likely to blow up half a punch, but you can get... The worst thing that happens, really, you can expect is a fire that involves radioactive materials and then sends the stuff up. And this is what happened with Chernobyl. So literally, you have one of the reactors catch fire because they haven't controlled it well. And you're sending out cesium-137 and other really nasty stuff in the atmosphere. So it's really, really bad. Okay. For nuclear bombs, we have a couple of different types. The whole trick is to try to... hold it together to take subcritical masses and make them critical, supercritical, so fast that they can become explosive before they basically melt down and go subcritical again. So there are two general types of fission bombs. One is called the gun type, and in the gun type, you take a subcritical mass here and a subcritical mass there, and you literally use conventional explosives to blow, say, this piece into that hole, okay? and you go from subcritical to critical very fast, at the sort of speed of this explosion, and then this thing will go. So this is known as a gun type, and this is similar to the one that was used on Hiroshima in August 1945. Another type is called the implosive type, and here you have a shell of plutonium, typically it's plutonium, surrounded by explosives, and you blow each element here of the explosives simultaneously. So you literally implode the plutonium from subcritical to critical extremely fast. And this was similar to the one that dropped on Nagasaki. The reason that I'm bringing all this up is to sort of make contact with some of the things that are happening in the world today. This is really hard to do technically, to get the timing just right. The timing's a little bit off. You'll make a mess. You may even make a nice fire that spews nasty stuff out, but you're not going to vaporize a city. So everything has to go all at the same time, and I've forgotten the timing constraint, but it's really tight. So technically, this is really hard to do. Technically, this isn't so hard to do. You have a chunk of uranium here, a chunk of uranium here, and you blow them together, and you get a bomb. What's hard here is the fact that uranium-235 amounts to about 0.4% of the uranium that you see in natural uranium. Most of the uranium that's out there is actually an isotope, which is U-238. And in U-238, if you hit it with a neutron, you don't get two neutrons, so you can't make things go boom. So in order to make a bomb, you have to separate the U-235 from the U-238 until it's pretty pure, up to like 90% pure or something. And then you can actually, it's weapons-grade uranium. So it turns out that it is really difficult to separate isotopes, which is why it's happily, technically hard to build this bomb, and annoyingly hard to get the uranium that you need to build that bomb. And so I think it's a good thing that for different reasons you have a difficult time with each of these paths. You can't separate the uranium chemically very well. Typically, it's done by diffusion or by centrifuge. And so the mass difference is very small, and that's what you're taking advantage of. If you have an isotope that has higher mass, it will diffuse slightly less quickly than some other isotope. Or if you have it in a big centrifuge, the heavier one will go to the bottom, and you just keep enriching by pulling out the lighter stuff until you eventually do it. And so, when you look in the news and you hear all this crap about uranium centrifuges, that's what it's all about, is trying to isolate the U-235, because that is sort of the easiest path to this kind of work. So, so, another thing that is of some importance to us that concerns nuclear physics is the fact that we depend on stars in a lot of ways. It's also true that we depend on stars in more ways than you might imagine. We certainly depend on our sun for energy. All of our energy is coming from the sun. But it's also true that in the early universe, for reasons we'll talk about at some point, what's out there is almost all hydrogen. You don't have uranium, you don't have iron, you don't have calcium, you don't have heavier elements out there, really. And yet, all of those heavy elements are what we are. So I wanted to talk for a minute about this is astronomy 101 in 30 seconds or less. If you have a universe that is filled with hydrogen, the density typically is the vacuum is typically much better than the best vacuum we can create on Earth. But nevertheless, you'll have atoms out there. And it may not seem like much, but they will interact gravitationally. So over time, if you have areas of slightly higher density, you will, in fact, the hydrogen will begin to condense. Okay? And what happens when it begins to condense is it will get hot. And it's an adiabatic condensation. If you take a tire pump for a bicycle tire and you do it, feel the nozzle, it's very hot. So if you compress a gas and you don't allow for the heat to go anywhere, it's very hot. And so that's sort of what's happening here. Gravitational potential energy is really turning into thermal energy. Now, as it gets hot, as we already know, you have radiation pressure for it.
How's the idea about it? We have a certain amount of heat transfer on the surface.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, it is bleeding off, so maybe it's not circulating down. But it bleeds off fairly slowly. It takes time to work its way out.
Oh, if you're in a vacuum. Yeah.
I mean, that's the radiating thing. So it will, you can get this thing denser and denser, it gets hot in the middle. You have basically infrared radiation pushing out, and you get a balance between gravity and radiation going out. Okay? And then it does flow. So you do lose energy. And as you lose energy, it compresses more, and the gravitational potential energy makes it hot in the middle, and you have to push it out. And this keeps going, and the temperature in the center of this thing gets hotter and hotter. And eventually, you will get it hot enough in the middle. And remember what you mean when you say hot. What you mean when you say something is hot, because you aren't doing thermal physics, statistical mechanics. But what happens if I have a certain amount of heat, and I have a gas with, say, 3 degrees of freedom, so it can move one of 3 dimensions, each degree of freedom gets 3/2 kT of that energy base. So as I add more energy in, I'm actually increasing the temperature of the thing. Increasing temperature basically is increasing the root mean square velocity. If I increase the velocity of charged particles, I can allow to get them closer and closer together. So as this thing gets hotter, you on average have more and more violent collisions, and eventually you get enough heat and you get the collisions to be violent enough that they become so close that you get strong enough. And when that happens, nuclear fusion commences and you begin to get processes where the hydrogen fuses into helium. And when that happens, you now are releasing a total new sort of energy, not just the gravitational potential stuff, but you have a lot of heat being generated in nuclear fusion. And that then pushes out. So you have a period of stability, but eventually you have gravity basically pulling in, it's very hot, you have a nuclear fusion process that's pushing out, and you end up burning the hydrogen and the helium in the core of the star and holding this thing together. So what you have here are pictured gas clouds where in the midst of them you're having this process beginning to happen. You're starting to condense into stars. Eventually what will happen is you'll have young stars born and they'll literally, the radiation pressure will blow away whatever gas didn't make it into the star. And here's an example of a young stellar cluster called the Pleiades that we see. So you have inside a star, eventually in the core you run out of hydrogen to burn, so it cools off, collapses, gets hotter, you start to burn the helium into carbon into oxygen, etc. So you'll have a shell where you're burning hydrogen, and in the core you might be burning helium. So you'll get it. Depending on the size of the star, you'll have different temperature ranges in here. So the speed with which things will burn and how high up the chain you can fuse things will depend a lot on the time that you, the amount of mass that you begin with. But there's a characteristic curve of the intrinsic brightness of the star's temperature, which you can actually figure out at what stage in a star's lifetime it is. I'll come back to that. Eventually, as the star gets much older, you'll actually have successive shells. If it's big enough and it can get hot enough in the center, you'll have successive shells where you're burning hydrogen out on the edges, helium inside of that, carbon inside of that, oxygen inside of that, silicon inside of that, and iron in the center. But it stops at iron, because I can make it as hot as I want, and I can't fuse iron into anything and make it happen. Okay? So things will stop at that point. The kinds of processes that happen are complicated, and but people have known for about 60, 70 years how all this works, basically. And there's some fun things that come out of this, because if you look at the various fusion processes, there are particular neutrinos that are formed. These photons that are formed, there's energy, and it's great, but that energy, they get rescattered, the energy gets separated. You don't ever see a photon from the center of the sun. The energy eventually works its way out. But these neutrinos that are formed, they don't interact readily with matter. So neutrinos that are formed in the core of the sun pass through us 8 minutes later. And for years, we were trying to look for the neutrinos coming from the sun, because this stuff was pretty well known in nuclear physics. Even the energy spectrum of the neutrinos was well predicted. And a guy named Ray Davis built an experiment in a mine in South Dakota, which is basically a huge vat of cleaning fluid. It had a lot of chlorine in it. And there was a process that was expected to happen where the neutrino would interact with the chlorine and create an argon isotope. An argon is chemically very unreactive, and you collect argon gas, basically, and count the number of argon atoms, and from that you can get a measure of the neutrino flow from the sun. And so they did this, and they found approximately one-third the number of neutrinos that they expected to see. And this was a puzzle for many, many years, probably about 40 years, until we discovered that neutrinos have mass, and there's a weird quantum mechanical process that happens where neutrinos, say these electron neutrinos, turn into different types of neutrinos that his experiment wasn't sensitive to, and we've since figured out how to see them. But we're pretty confident about what's going on in the centers of stars. What happens when you reach this stage? You can get weird sorts of instability that I don't pretend to understand very well, and I think actually it's not sure how anybody understands it. But in principle now, the gist of it is this, and don't tell Dan Watson I said this, because he'll laugh at me. But basically, you can imagine you're now burning, you get to the core, you find something you can no longer burn and create energy, so it cools off. So that will begin to collapse. As that begins to collapse, it's no longer gravitation, it's no longer pushing out on the stuff up above it, that will also begin to collapse. And so as things begin to collapse, then in the center you're getting hotter and hotter, and you can begin to fuse all sorts of crap and all sorts of crap, which creates all sorts of energy pushing out, and literally the star can just blow up. So there are different types of things. These are called supernovas, but there are different types of supernovas that you can take an astronomy course if you want to know. But one of the things that happens is you have tremendous amount of energy available in a very short time, and it is at this point you can begin to fuse things greater than iron and create things, even though it takes energy to do it. You can absorb that energy and create them. So it turns out that the heavy elements over here are all formed when stars go supernova. And when they do, of course, they're also blowing a lot of gas out into interstellar space and intergalactic space even. You get the heavy elements coming out. So if you imagine early in the age of the universe, before you had managed to have stars actually moving back, because they lived a long time, there are some about a 10 billion year life cycle, more massive stars turn out to live less long. But those early stars were formed mostly of hydrogen. Later stars actually have some heavy elements in them. But you can look out and see some spectacular views of things which are called nebula, loosely, but here's the Crab Nebula that we actually have historical records by Chinese astronomers and Arab astronomers. because they actually saw the star go. When a supernova goes, it's extremely bright, and it can be the brightest thing in the sky while it's going. They often don't last all that long at that level, but you can see the gas that's blown off, it's excited still by the central star, so it glows. That's known as the Crab Nebula. Let me think a moment about... I'm sort of at a... might be a good place to stop. Probably makes sense to stop here. Because the next thing I want to do is talk about the interaction of radiation with matter.